think I think we were first.
We don't have Findlay yet. Yeah, we'll start with the other two.
How do we bring up our one thing anymore?
What?
Well, how do we get into
Olus? Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development, our first interim committee meeting on September 28th. The first thing we have to do is adopt committee rules. I'm going to open a work session for that purpose. Committee, the rules are before you. I don't see really any difference, with one exception that Victoria pointed out, and that is that in number 8, whereas it previously took 2 members to request a roll call vote, it now requires just 1. Otherwise, it appears to be the same as the rules we've adopted and used in the past. Unless there's any...
Chair, would you be interested in an amendment to make meetings begin no earlier than 9 o'clock?
Representative Wisner, I would, but I'm not sure that the speaker would be...
Thank you for that.
Thank you for the suggestion. Representative Wisner?
Chair Reed, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Thank you. Representative Wisner moves to adopt proposed committee rules. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, the motion carries. The rules are adopted, and that completes that work session, so I'll close that work session, which puts us back to our regularly scheduled content and an informational meeting on guided pathways. I'm going to open that and invite the presidents forward. We're going to unfortunately, we have one who just took out for a moment. We're going to go in a different order, I guess. Ken, you're going to start us off, I understand. Please. We're flexible and adadaptable here.
Sure, why not?
So you were going to take on Senate Bill 81, or we're going to go in the other order? Okay, so first we're going to have an update on the implementation of the Oregon Promise, Senate Bill 81, which we all played a role in. Mr. Cannon, welcome.
Yes, thank you very much, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And wanted to provide for the committee an update on the implementation of Senate Bill 81 that passed in 2015, signed by the governor in late July, I believe. And we are busy, very busy, I should say, putting this program into place for the coming academic year. So wanted to provide a status update on that. So as you'll recall, what is the Oregon Promise? That's how I'll refer to this bill, is the Oregon Promise. Those words are in the text, and we're going with that sort of branding and labeling for the program. So what is the Oregon Promise? It is a state-funded grant program that covers all or almost all community college tuition costs for an eligible student. This program will be first available for the 2016-17 academic year. I want to be really clear, we're not putting any of those tuition dollars into place during the current, just begun academic year, but this will be for students who start community college next fall. Those students have to enroll at a community college within 6 months of their high school completion, their high school graduation, or its equivalent. So this is really important. I know all of you understand that, but I want to underscore that this program is for students who transition immediately, essentially, within 6 months from high school to college. That means the majority, the large majority of community college students do not qualify for the program. It's for those who are transitioning directly from high school, and the program is administered by our Office of Student Access and Completion. A couple other notes on eligibility. Students have to be residents of Oregon. They have to complete an application, and I'll give you a glimpse of that application that's under development now, but an Oregon Promise application, as well as their FAFSAs for the coming school year, or an approved alternative if they're not eligible to complete a FAFSA. They have to have earned a high school cumulative GPA of 2.5 or higher. Again, they have to enroll within 6 months of completing their high school or GED. They have to enroll in the community college within that period of time, and they have to accept all federal and state financial aid that is awarded to them.
Can we jump in with questions, I hope,
yes,
as we go? Representative Wisner.
Please do.
Thank you. Mr. Cannon, How's this going to integrate with opportunity grants? Because now we've changed opportunity grants to issuing those earlier. So are they going to be eligible for both? Can you please discuss that, or do you have that later in your PowerPoint?
Yeah, you'll see it on a financial basis in a couple more slides. I'll just say a word now, and then you'll see sort of a chart that shows that interaction in a couple of slides. In a word, most students will apply for the Oregon Promise dollars through a specific Oregon Promise application, as well as the FAFSA. The FAFSA is their application, in essence, for an Oregon Opportunity Grant. It will be possible. Some students will qualify for an Oregon Opportunity Grant and the Oregon Promise dollars on top of that. And you'll see that modeled in a slide upcoming.
Thank you.
There are certain conditions for maintaining an award, and those are described on this slide. Eligibility beyond the first year continues for students who maintain that GPA requirement of 2.5, make satisfactory academic progress as defined by their institution, maintain at least half-time enrollment in 3 out of 4 terms annually, continue to submit their annual FAFSAs or alternative, and submit a renewal application and transcripts as required annually. Students who fail to...
Just a second. I don't see minimum hours. Is there minimum hours they have to be taking?
Yes. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, students are required to enroll at least half-time. So we've defined that as six, following the Pell definition, we've defined that as 6 credit hours per term for 3 terms annually. So a student who failed to be at least a half-time student for an academic year would not continue to qualify for the program.
Half or less?
Half, well, fewer than 6 credits, Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, fewer than 6 credits in a term would disqualify a student from continuing to receive funding under the program.
And notice the description at the bottom, unless the requirement is waived by OSAC. Has there been discussion about what circumstances would cause OSAC to waive those requirements?
Mr. Chair, not really. It is one of the issues with which we haven't dealt in any depth. We do envision there will be some process, as permitted by the bill, some process for students to attain a waiver under hardship cases to the GPA requirement. The 2.5 GPA requirement.
Representative Gallegos?
Mr. Cannon, these conditions seem pretty similar to federal other financial aid. Is that correct? They're pretty much the same.
Chair Reed, Representative Gallegos, yes and no. So the student's eligibility for federal financial aid does require at least half-time standing, and that is defined identically. The distinction, however, is that students may receive federal financial aid even if they are attending only sporadically at half-time. So they can take a term off or a couple of terms off, re-enroll, and as long as they re-enroll a half-time student, they will achieve federal financial aid. This or qualify for federal financial aid. This bill that you adopted establishes very clearly that a student needs to be continuously enrolled for at least, you know, what we understand as sort of full time, three terms in an academic year or in a calendar year. And if they fail to maintain continuous enrollment under the bill, they are essentially booted out of the program. Mm-hmm. To be very clear, they're not booted out of the community college. They're not booted off the federal financial aid system. They will have options for continuing their progress, but they will not have Oregon Promise dollars to support them.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Director Cannon, these are rules that came out of the bill, or these are rules that came out of the HEC?
Chair Reed, Representative Wisnett, everything I've described so far comes from the bill. Now, there will be some slides here, and so we haven't imported any of our own ideas yet. There will be some slides here And there's a lot that's not in this presentation that that we have come up with to help clarify this and come up with some of the definitions around it.
I thought our objective here was to help the 40-40-20 and be sure that we get more people. I'm worrying that, you know, and I'm compassionate, everyone knows that, but, you know, there's circumstances. Are we making it too easy to not push it? I was looking at this as a way to help you get your 2 years in 2 years, or get your certificate or get your ready for a four-year school. But you feel that what you've told me so far, I'm not, you know, there's conditions. Are we really using our money to help move people into help our economy, which is, and get them into the workforce sooner? Am I missing, or do you think it's going to be enough?
Sure, Representative Wisnett. I think the bill certainly provides a structure for supporting students who are making progress. I think your concern, as if I understand it correctly, and one that we share, is really the question of what are we doing in addition to tuition dollars? How are we helping to increase the likelihood that these students complete their certificates, degrees, or their courses of study successfully? And we're very grateful that the bill provides the opportunity for the commission through rulemaking and through investment to do other things, not merely provide tuition grants, but take other steps to support student success. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later.
Mr. Chair, I think that was the whole committee. We were impressed by this and pushed it to the last minute because of what happened in Tennessee and the number of volunteers or mentors that were identified. So you can talk about that. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Rudin?
Well, I know this is in addition to other grants. Do we have a list somewhere that would show all the possible grants that a student might receive?
Chair Reed, Representative Rudin, we'd be happy to provide that for state-administered grants, and our Office of Student Access and Completion does administer a number of them, including the Oregon Opportunity Grant and now the Oregon Promise Grant, but there are others as well.
Yeah, I'd love to see that at some point.
Great. Thank you, Representative Rudin. Please go ahead.
A few additional conditions. Students are eligible for up to 90 credit hours. At that point in time, after they've earned 90 credit hours, they would no longer qualify for tuition grants under the program. Likewise, they would no longer qualify after they've completed one of the sort of stop points described here, either a transfer curriculum, an associate degree, or a CTE certificate and program. Grant size, and this really probably becomes most evident on the following slide, which is a chart, but I'll just note a couple of things here. The minimum full-time grant amount, so for a full-time student attending for an academic year, would be $1,000. That's for students whose tuition is actually fully covered by other sources of aid, the federal Pell Grant, the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Those students who are very low-income students, high-need students, would still qualify for the minimal grant amount of $1,000. The maximum grant amount for students who qualify for less federal or no federal and state aid would be up to the average tuition charged at all Oregon community colleges, or the actual tuition if it's less. Recipients are required to pay $50 per term as a copay, essentially.
So I think I may be confused on the first one. If a student then has tuition fully covered from federal sources and the opportunity grant, there, what is the additional grant going to then?
So, Chair Reed, it's a good question. The additional dollars would help to support or offset costs associated with fees, costs associated with textbooks, costs associated with other living costs. The concern from some who worked on the bill, and I think it fairly reflects the point of view of our commission, is that these very high-need students, low-income students, face quite a few barriers beyond tuition to completing, and that the program should include something even for those students whose tuition dollars are offset by Pell and the Opportunity Grant.
Okay.
This slide
understood.
Gives a sense of how it will work for students at different income levels. So the x-axis, sort of the horizontal axis here, shows students with expected family contributions from zero at the left-hand side. Those would be the very lowest income students. They or their families qualify, if you will, for the greatest amount of federal and state financial aid. To very high income students or higher income students on the right-hand side, and this sort of goes infinitely to the right, but obviously we stopped it. The black bar, the black line, is the average tuition at the Oregon Community Colleges for a full-time student, and full-time here described as 15 credits per term. So that's the 4,100. You'll see that in the blue that the federal Pell Grant program does meet or exceed the cost, the average cost of tuition at Oregon Community Colleges for the lowest income students, so those with expected family contributions of $1,000 or less. In the green bars, the darkest green is the Oregon Promise dollars, and you can see the $1,000 that kicks in on top of Pell for all students, at least for students whose tuition is already covered by the Pell Grant. The Oregon Opportunity Dollar Grant is shown on the very first three bars or four three bars with its redesign, and it'll be focused on the lowest income students. And I think the only other feature of this slide is the a red bar that converts expected family contribution into something we're a little bit more accustomed to seeing when we think about income or means, and that's estimated annual gross income. Or AGI, and so that's the scale there is on the right-hand side. So you can see by low income, we're talking about students with or their families with expected AGIs of 30,000 or less, and then moving up. So this is how the program works. The majority of Oregon Promise dollars will go to students with higher AGIs in order to help fill the gap between any financial aid they might receive, in many cases no state or federal financial aid, and the cost of tuition.
There's a lot going on in that slide. Thank you.
I'll note that all of this will be prorated for students who attend less than full-time. So this describes a sort of full-time 15-credit hour student.
Representative Rudin?
I'm not trying to sandbag you, really, but do you happen to know the average fees that a student pays and how that compares with tuition?
Representative Reardon, it varies a lot by campus, and we do have that information. It is somewhere in the neighborhood. The average, I believe, is in the sort of $500 to $700 range for a full-time student per year. So it's a significant contributor to costs for students. This modeling and the basis of the modeling that I'm using to estimate the cost of this program does not include fees in the coverage of the Oregon Promise program. It is possible for the commission under the bill to include fees in the calculation of these grants. We've had a pretty robust debate, I would say, at the advisory group level about that question. We're meeting again today with a policy advisory group that's helping weigh in. It's not yet a settled question. Including fees will certainly increase the cost of the program. As I said, they vary a lot by campus. Probably would have some effect on how colleges treat fee setting in the future. Our current best thinking is that we would not include fees in the calculations or in the grants, but it's to some extent at least an open question still.
Thank you.
Okay. A few more slides about the implementation of the program. So we will open an online application on November 1st of this year, again, essentially for high school seniors or GED enrollees, and close that application in the spring. There will be a paper form as well. Students will be required to submit the FAFSA during roughly the same time period or an alternative for students who are not eligible to file the FAFSA. Here's a view of a very simple application. We're not talking about multiple pages or complex information. We do need evidence of their interest. And we'll ask for very standard information that should not require much time on their part. The that's how a paper application will look. The online version will be a series of screens with drop-down menus. Again, should take maybe 5 or 10 minutes to complete, if that. We've, in order to advise the commission on its and staff on the both the remaining policy details as well as the implementation of the program, we've created a policy advisory group and includes several legislators who were involved in putting the bill together, presidents and staff from community colleges, several board members, student groups, staff of the Department of Ed and K-12 districts, our own staff and stakeholder groups. That policy advisory group met August 30th. It will meet again this afternoon, to help advise staff and ultimately the commission on putting the details in place. We've also been working with a technical advisory group comprised of financial aid directors from colleges and universities that met September 2nd. And we were really in continuous consultation with that group of folks whose participation and expertise is really critical for effectively implementing the bill. Community college financial aid directors had a quarterly meeting August 6th, and we are in the process of developing administrative rules that will reflect really a lot of the and definitional issues associated with putting a program like this together. We're working to get these details ironed out really in October, because high school students this fall really deserve to know whether or not they qualify, how they qualify, what the process will be for accessing the dollars. And so we're quite cognizant of their need and the need of those who work with them, their families, counselors, et cetera, for clarity about this. We believe we can manage this program for all eligible students within the $10 million appropriation that was provided in conjunction with Senate Bill 81. So this slide walks through the assumptions that are involved in that. We do assume an increased tuition. We assume we make an assumption about flat Pell Grant funding from the federal government. We've looked very closely at the students who graduated high school in 2014 and enrolled in a community college last fall. That's about, as you see there, maybe 20% of the total from that class. We've assumed that that will grow as a result of this program, and we'll see a greater percentage than that from the high school class of 2016 participate next fall in the program or enroll in a community college. But we've looked really closely at their credit-taking patterns, what they would have qualified if this program had, for if this program had been available at that time, their GPAs, and we, put the projected cost range of just the tuition piece of this program at under the $10 million. We're still working on refining these figures. Obviously, it is a projection. There's a lot of assumptions that have gone into this. There are certainly risks involved in saying, okay, we're gonna open these doors, and we only have $10 million to spend. And one of the things, questions the commission is really interested in understanding is sort of if the dollars were not sufficient in next year or in subsequent years, should the program be continued, how would we manage this? How would we triage, if you will, the program in order to make it work within the legislatively appropriated budget?
Representative Wizen has a question. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Cannon, this committee heard the Tennessee Promise presentation, is really impressed. Are you still following that? Because do they have a student body that's gone through this now? Is their $14 million working? How successful were they in getting the, what was the term they used, mentors or advocates or whatever their term was used?
Representative Reed, Representative Wisnett, the Tennessee Promise is in place for the first time statewide this fall. So it's sort of first class is enrolling now. And I don't know, they started a little earlier than we did. So they're maybe second or third week at this point. So we do have preliminary enrollment numbers from Tennessee that have been useful as we've looked to try to understand what kind of enrollment bump we might see. We will not have anything from Tennessee around student success. How many of those students
do they have the Aspire, I guess is the term, or what the that was a big thing for me. Is that's a number they said they were going to get was unbelievable. And that's
Representative Reed, Representative Wisnett. The Tennessee program has several features that ours doesn't, and others that we're looking at for potential replication. One of them is the requirement that students in Tennessee meet with a community-based mentor, and that was a significant investment and feature of their program.
Representative Wisnett and I are needed briefly for a quorum next door. We'll be right back. Representative Gagos is the gavel.
Continue.
Just a couple of more slides. We are working hard to get the word out and doing that through several channels. We've acquired the domain names www.oregonpromise.org and .com. Those are active. They'll direct to pages on our website that are explain the program. We have a general email address that folks can use to submit questions. We've created a fact sheet that explains much of what I've described to you already and more. And we are in the midst of a much more robust outreach and communications plan. It will include a short online video that we'll be putting out here in the next couple of weeks, as well as flyers and other informational material, particularly to target those students in the high school class of 2016, this year's seniors, who may be eligible for the program. So quite a bit more to come in terms of outreach and communications under the bill. But to come quickly, we're close to being able to finalize those materials. There are a couple of slides here that really get into some of the detail that the commission will need to deal with. And so I'm not going to run through each and every one of these bullet points, but if there are questions about sort of where we're heading with any of these sort of, I would describe them as sort of in the weeds pieces associated with the bill, don't hesitate to stop me. You know, questions like how does a GED recipient's date of completion get factored into the bill or factored into their eligibility? How and when will funds be released to schools and to students under the program? This has involved quite a bit of staff time to put together a good understanding of how we'll proceed through implementation. There are some key decisions for the commission, including some that were touched on in the previous couple of slides, but I'll note a few here. We've already talked a little bit about the potential for an appeals process for students who fail to maintain the 2.5 GPA. Questions about whether there would be likewise some process for students who stop, who are not enrolled at halftime status, to get back onto the program through some sort of appeal. The second to last bar, potential investments and supports for student completion. So again, we're still trying to lock down, if you will, to the extent we can, the cost of the tuition grants, and therefore what will be left over for us to potentially invest in supports for student success, and what those supports might look like. So some vigorous conversation. Aspire comes up as a sort of community college-based version of Aspire comes up as a potential way for us to better support students, not only in the enrollment and their tuition, but in their success at completing certificate or degree or their goals. And there are a number of other options sort of on the table as potential investments that we could make to support their success. And I'll note here, too, that I would say a big question, not for today, but certainly a year from now, will be how the commission will be, how our staff will be approaching the potential 2017-18 funding cycle. So we'll have to have something to say to the high school class of 2017, today's juniors, about whether or not this program will be in place for them. And of course, we'll need to say that before the legislative session in 2017, when presumably this funding and this program will be taken up. So I'm sure we'll be in conversation with you about your expectations for this program into the next biennium. That is all for my slides. I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Representative, something I probably should know, but I want to double check. If I'm moved It mentioned residency requirement, but if I move to this country and say as a sophomore, and I've been going to Oregon schools for a number of years, am I eligible for this?
Yes. Representative Gallegos, Representative Reardon, the residency requirement is for 12 months before the start of the program. And so in your example, a student who moved and established residency as a high school sophomore would be eligible for
But not necessarily a U.S. citizenship.
Again, yes. So as long as you have established residency and you meet the other requirements of the bill, including filing a FAFSA or an alternative to a FAFSA, if you are not eligible to complete the FAFSA, then yes, you would be qualify for funding under the bill.
Thank you.
Other questions? I guess that was a pretty thorough presentation, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the hearing on the Mr. Promise and right in time to start our next session. So we're going to open a hearing on guided pathways and invite are we going to invite the whole panel up, or let's get all four, one, two, three. Three folks.
Yep.
Sorry for missing the last bit of the last one. It was a quick adoption of committee rules in the Ways and Means Committee. We're back. And it seems to me the transition here is an appropriate one, given that we want people, as Representative Wisdom was saying before, be headed in the right direction and being effective. I don't know which order you all have in mind, but any one that you prefer is fine with us.
I thought we passed a bill saying that kicker goes to community colleges.
That would be nice.
We didn't do that? I missed that.
I missed you vote on that one, yeah. Who's first? Thank you. Mr. Finley, please.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, Dan Finley, Director, Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Purpose of our testimony today is to introduce the concept of guided pathways to success, or GPS, as a means of assisting students in making effective choices when developing and executing an education plan. My colleagues will provide an operational definition of GPS, discuss examples of success from the national stage, and describe how the GPS model can help Oregon students to persist in their studies and successfully complete their personal education missions. And with that, I will turn it over to President Finley.
Good morning. Chair Reed and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Heyman. I'm the president of Lynn Benton Community College. I wanted to just start by giving a little historical perspective to the whole idea of guided pathways, which I think has had its beginning probably in a variety of places, but probably the most concrete is back in 2011-2012, the American Association of Community Colleges began to talk about a different way of thinking about how we structure the educational experience for our students at our community college, and they put out the 21st Century Report. I would note that our own Mary Spielley, president of Blaine Community College, was a part of writing that document, in which we began to lay out what we saw as the future for community colleges and the ways in which we would better serve the needs of our students. There were 11 recommendations that came out of that report, and I identified two of them, a focus on access to a focus on access and student success, and that we accomplish that by developing clear, coherent educational pathways for our students. I would say that ever since that report came out, many of our institutions began the work of thinking about how we would restructure that educational experience for students and create, I think, a greater opportunity for their success. 2 years after the report, another report, an implementation report, came out of the American Association of Community Colleges, and both Cam Preuss here and myself were part of the writing of that document, in which we began to flesh out what that what that pathway might look like. And I've quoted a section out of that for you, but I just want to identify that. A pathway is a highly structured, coherent educational experience that is built around and through an area of study. The student's experience includes a development of a clear academic plan, a defined learning sequence, engagement in high-impact educational practices, built-in advising and other student support, integrated hands-on and co-curricular learning, and a clear route to a transfer or to employment. So you can see that at the national level and at the state level, we've been involved in continuing this work of translating the student experience into something that is clearly focused on their success and their completion. Most recently, in fact, just 3 months ago, Harvard Press came out with a book, Redesigning American Community Colleges, and I think many of our campuses are reading that book as a playbook for the next step in our work of defining guided pathways for our students. And again, a quote from that in a document. But I would just clearly what is happening on our campuses, and I think this is an extremely positive experience for our students, is that we are really, I think, digging down into the ways in which the students experience our campuses to make sure that we partner with them in a way in which we lead them not just in our door but out our door with that certificate and that diploma in hand so that they are more able to be successful in their lives and community, in their families, in their work, in their career. And that really is the point of the GPS, is that it's not just about their experience in the community college. It's about the experience that they have after they leave us, and we're committed to that success. I'll just a couple things that are happening at my institution that I would highlight, and I don't think we're unique at all, I'm sure. We are focused on advising, and to highlight that focus, we've changed the language that we use. And so we talk about intrusive advising, and what that means is we don't have our door open for students. We're calling them up, and we're dragging them in to their advising experience because we know that those who most need it are probably the ones that are most inclined to avoid it. And we know that having that partner in their success, in their educational pathway, is a critical component to that's the guided word in GPS, that we come alongside them, that we don't just create opportunity for them, but we actually join with them in turning that opportunity into a success for them and for their future. We're also, one of the things we did this year at our institution, again, I'm sure other institutions as well, is we've established a clearly defined first term for every one of our majors. And so every student who comes to us doesn't come to us with that course book open and going, what of those 1,000 classes should I start with? We talk with that student very directly about what are your educational goals with us, and based on their understanding of those goals, we're able to show them a starting point that puts them in the best position to complete. And we've created that for all of our majors, so that a pathway has to have a start point, and so we're working hard to define that for each one of our students. We still have to track with them to bring them to a point in which they experience success. And I'll tell one more thing, and I'll hand it off to my partner here. One of the things we sort of dream about, and this may seem funny, but many of our students come to us with an experience with a video game, which I don't have any experience with, but I know they do. And we've been thinking about how to use the technology of video games to help students to understand their educational pathway. And one of the things we're toying with is, if you ever worked with a flight simulator scenario, is to turn their educational pathway into a flight plan. And every time they bring up their portal into Lynn Benton Community College, they will see where their plane is on that flight path, whether they're high or low, coming in too slow, whether they're still on the right trajectory to land on the airport that they've chosen. It creates a clear visual representation so that they don't have to ask us where they are on their plan. They know where they are, and they know how to make the next step to stay on course. So that's where we're at.
Thank you. President Preuss.
Yes. Good morning, members of the committee and Chair Reed. For the record, I'm Cam Preuss. I'm president at Blue Mountain Community College, and I'll just say that you all look a little different without your cowboy hats on. Thanks for coming and enjoying a bit of Roundup with us. Has it just been 2 weeks ago now? So thank you for that. I guess I'm here to talk about Blue Mountain's experience, but before I do that, I'm going to set a little context for a little bigger picture for Oregon. And many of you know that I was 13 years in the chair that Dan now sits in, and I was commissioner of community colleges. And in that role, we probably a decade ago, decided that we really needed to help students who weren't able to complete a full associate degree, a full two-year degree. We needed to look at ways in which they could come into the college, be successful in earning a certificate, and return to work, and then be able to come back and add another credential, what is now in the vernacular nationally known as stackable credentials. Oregon was on the forefront of that with about four other states. We called it career pathways, and we took a career and technical degree that was generally a two-year degree, and made breaks in it where employers said, that's enough skill to get an entry-level job. That's enough skill to get the next step. And so Oregon is nationally known for that work. That work was clearly all around career and technical education, because the vantage point we had was we wanted to wrap services around students so that they were successful and so they could get into the labor market. We didn't attempt the same thing with our transfer degree, our AAOT, Associate of Arts Transfer Degree. What you're hearing now is more concentration on that academic side, on that pure transfer side. About 8 years ago, the legislature gave the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development an assignment when we received $500 million from the legislature in the budget to start describing some performance outcomes that we would be held accountable for. And we had some performance requirements that were already as part of our budget. And we gathered a group together, and we looked at that information and decided that there were things that the legislature wanted to know from us that we were happy to provide. And yet there was other information that was probably more important to student success that we wanted to know. And so we built a matrix, if you will, and expanded the number of performance outcomes that we were looking at for community colleges. So really these two statewide pieces of work, the student success, which became after a report back to the legislature in 2009, we continued that student success work. So we have a student success oversight committee, and we have the Career Pathways Alliance. And really those two things come together nicely. As Greg said, Oregon has experience in not letting students fail by concentrating on how to shorten the pathway or how to bring services around a student. I think all of us have had a bachelor's experience, a university experience, and at community colleges 3, 5, 8, 10 years ago, the experience of students was much more fluid than a university experience. And that's kind. There are people critics who have said that community colleges could have a tagline of you have an opportunity to fail here, because we didn't have a lot of student supports. We didn't have guided pathways. We let students make their own choices, and we gave them way too many choices. So, again, just trying to bring these threads together. At Blue Mountain Community College, we were part of a statewide grant from the U.S. Department of Labor, and one of the things that it asked us to try was something called a success coach. And this was a grant for not necessarily students that were coming right out of high school, but for adults who had lost their job and needed to get reengaged and retrained and get back into the labor market. And so what we did after that grant went away is we kept those success coaches because they deal with the real life of a student. So we have a combined model at Blue Mountain of a faculty advisor who does a lot of the academic counseling that you would expect. And then we have five success coaches that are working in tandem with the faculty advisor, the academic advisor, to ensure that student success, drawing on things that my colleague, Dr. Heyman, was speaking about. And we have also, reasserted the state has an Associate of Science transfer in business degree. The state also has an Associate of Science Oregon transfer degree in computer science. We didn't have those on our books. We just this last year adopted them because, again, it winnows down the choices for a student. So if a student knows they want to be a math or computer science something at the end of their college career, what we've done is we have minimized their opportunity to make a wrong choice by adopting these different degrees. And that goes hand in hand with the Oregon, the AAOT, the Associate of Arts Transfer Degree. So one last example is many of you have probably heard my other colleagues from Eastern Oregon talk about the Eastern Promise. And the Eastern Promise is a combination partnership between the Intermountain ESD, Blue Mountain Community College, Treasure Valley Community College, and Eastern Oregon University. And the partnership that we have there is to partner with our 33 school districts across our territory, if you will, and to ensure that any early college credit that a student takes in any of those high schools has the same outcomes as a college course would. So writing 121 is the outcomes are exactly the same as they would be at Blue Mountain or Treasure Valley, and meet the minimum requirements at Eastern Oregon University for the general ed. I make that example because I actually have a T-shirt that the first year we launched this, which was the we piloted 12-13, so 13-14 was really the first year of Eastern Promise, and the first, I don't know, maybe 250 students got a T-shirt, and on the back was a mock-up of a transcript, and it had the courses you needed to take in order to get your first year under your belt for an AAOT. And we also had a companion piece of paper that said, here's what it looks like at Blue Mountain Community College. This is the course number, and this is the title. And then if you're at Pendleton High School, here's the teacher you would have for writing 121, and this is what the course is called. And we did that for every high school in across the 33 school districts. Again, it's about guiding students to where and how to make good choices in their academic career. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I have one question maybe, and then hopefully the committee has some as well. One thing that strikes me as a tension you're probably navigating is the opportunity to let students at whatever point they enter or begin their interaction with you to experiment, to figure out what those choices are. If, as you've said, they wanted to be a computer science person or something entirely different, To what degree, and President Hayman, you mentioned the clear, articulated first year. Is there a lot of overlap amongst those? Where do students get to say, I don't know what I want to do yet? How does that work?
Chair Reed and members of the committee, it's a great question. There is a lot of overlap between the starting points for varying degrees and careers. But even with that overlap, it's important for the student to have a sense of connection between that starting point and where they want to go. But there are plenty of opportunities for them to change direction while they're with us. What we want is for them not to be in a position of having no direction.
Of course. Thank you. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. One is I'm just curious. Help me to sort of see the current status of community colleges. Because I'm thinking about my experience way back, and it was I was working. I needed to find an inexpensive way to go to school. Also, the culture of the university was sort of like something I wasn't used to. But I also wanted to find a convenient opportunity, so someplace close to home. And I'm just curious now that we're talking about my sense of community colleges in the state of Oregon are that they're unique. They have different cultures, different offerings, and so on. And is there, do we see students moving to different locations within the state to go to a particular community college? And if that's the case, do we have to deal with housing? Do we have to deal with transportation at community colleges in a way we didn't before?
Chair Reed, Representative Gallegos, this is an interesting question. We just finished a report for our Board of Education, and the title of it was Who is Blue? Because since we're Blue Mountain. And we did look at our last year's student body, and we track their zip codes. And this is our reality. I'm pretty certain if Portland Community College was sitting at the table, they would have a different. But for a rural community college, 95% of our students come from a 978, fill in the blank, zip code. So that's Eastern Oregon from the Dalles east, yeah. Is the 95% of our students. So 95, I would say that our offerings are representative of our regional economy and our regional community. Having recently been in the area, you may or may not know that Blue Mountain Community College has one of the last, if he still has one, maybe we have two farms, actual operating farms in the state of Oregon where students get hands-on experience about operating a farm and livestock and all of that. Rock Creek Community College on the west end of the Portland district had a farm, maybe still has a farm, but it's I'm over making my point, but I think you understand that we still have students who need housing, who need transportation. All of those are very relevant issues for students.
Please.
That sort of makes me think of another issue or question. It has to do with coming away. I was so happy to go to the Pendleton Round. It was my first time, and I came away with a greater appreciation of cultural competence and cultural diversity. I can tell you that, and recognize that area, that geographic area of Pendleton and Eastern Oregon there, has a particular Western culture that is unique, is sort of an enclave of a particular demographic. So I'm just curious about, again, the state of diversity within the state with regard to our community colleges. How can we sort of standardize and at the same time offer the diversity, offer the creative opportunity to do other things and respond, again, as I'm thinking, to particular kinds of students?
Representative Gelson, members of the committee, that is a great question. I think the great strength of the community college is that we are designed to meet the needs of our specific community. And while we create clear pathways within our institution, it doesn't mean that my pathway looks the same as the pathway at Blue Mountain. At Lynn Benton, we have, in our region, we have one of the fastest growing exotic metals industries in the world, actually, producing about 80% of the titanium products in the aerospace industry right here. So we have whole programs that specifically focus on the skills associated with that industry, and that's true of each one of our community colleges. We're designed to meet the needs of our communities.
Interesting. Questions? Representative Rudin, please.
Good morning, and thanks for being here. There's been a lot of work on CTE at the lower grades. I mean, I'm advocating for 7th grade, 8th grade through high school. Do you have any evidence or anything that you're doing to really promote the integration of those programs so that kids do arrive at your doors and a greater clarity about what they want to do when they grow up? And
Mr. Chair, Representative Reardon, really excellent question. One of the roles of our ESD in Eastern Oregon is the management of federal Carl Perkins dollars, which are focused on CTE. I'm pretty sure you're familiar with those. They did some work for the 11 to 14 community, if you will, in looking at where, not just where Carl Perkins dollars were spent, but where were the CTE programs across the districts, whether they were ag or business or computer science or nursing, allied health, and did a matrix of where that was happening. And then what we were able to do was do what used to be called a 2+2. 2 years in the high school, 2 years at the college, we were able to plug in our CTE programs to the programs that are available, let's say, in Hermiston, Oregon. They have 6 career pathways. Yeah. They include welding, allied health. So we were able to just take our program and ensure that there was articulation between the programs and matriculation of the students. And we see, I don't know, this is probably why 95% of our students come from our zip code area there. Because we work very hard to ensure that that anything that's offered that's CTE in the high school has a walk across to the community college.
That's your regional CTE coordinators that are working on that.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Can I add?
Please.
Representative Weirden, members of the committee. I just think that's a critical question, because for pathways to work, it can't just be in the community college. It's got to start, you know, pre-K and run through their the end of their educational experience and into a career, which even then their educational experience hopefully doesn't end. One of the things that we're doing in our area, which again is not unique, but we've connected with, it's a project called Pipeline. We've connected with our major business employers, our K-12 district, and the community college to create a pipeline which includes a career and starts in middle school and helps students to think about the opportunities that they have and helps their parents to think about the opportunities they have in a career technical field. One example of the ways in which I think those connections work is during the opening of K-12 in the Albany School District this year, we had every one of the high school teachers tour one of those businesses, one of those manufacturing facilities, and meet with the community college, in which we talked about how we work together to create that pathway for our students. And so it really is based on a relationship that is, you know, the student gets lost because we don't have the relationship. And so we're really focused on how do we create the relationships with K-12 and with business so that the pathway exists for us and then for them.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is an important topic. I know we are all very interested in, and we want to continue the conversations. We head to the next session.
Thank you very much.
We're going for a record today, committee. I think the number of presidents we can have in a single hearing. You may recall during the session we heard the news about new presidents at the University of Oregon and Eastern Oregon University. They're both here, and we want to hear from them. We didn't plan in advance whether you both want to be here at the dais together. That's perfectly fine with us, or if someone wants to go first. Why don't you both come up unless someone objects, and we'll hear from you together. Please, President Schill, President Insko. Before you came in, President Price noted that we all look different here than we did in Pendleton a couple of weeks ago. So that seemed like a good place to start. But we're glad you're here, and
thank you.
To hear from you. Thanks. Go ahead, please.
Sure. Chair Reed and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Schill, and I was recently selected as the 18th president of the University of Oregon. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and I'd like to share with you a little bit about myself, update you on the goals of the university, and give you some information about how our new governance model is working to benefit students, faculty, and staff. First, though, I want to take a moment to thank you. I would like to thank you all for the increased funding provided to Oregon public universities during the 2015 legislative session. My first meeting in this building was with Governor Brown the morning you received the May revenue forecast. Now, as a dean, I always had a policy of never to ask for money on my first date with somebody, but I violated that policy that morning, and I asked the governor for more funding. I did make the ask, and you delivered. Thank you. The $700 million budget approved for universities was the first significant reinvestment by the state in decades, and it is allowing us to expand opportunity and access to higher education for Oregon students. At the University of Oregon, we have expanded our Pathway Oregon program. This nationally recognized program provides for full tuition for academically qualified Oregonians who are Pell Grant eligible. These are the students with great need who might not otherwise go to college. Not only do we cover their tuition, but really importantly, we also wrap services around them, advising, support, tutoring, so that they can have their very best chance at not only flourishing in their education, but staying in college, graduating, and importantly, graduating on time. Also, with the additional state money, we have established a graduation assistance program. These are grants for upperclassmen who have exhausted financial aid opportunities and are in danger of dropping out. Because of you, Oregon students who might not have gone to college are starting classes this morning. Because of your investment, the sometimes overwhelming process of choosing a major and registering for classes is less daunting. Because of your leadership, students who were at risk of dropping out are now on track to earn their degrees. Let me tell you a little bit about myself, and it may explain why I'm so passionate about the issues of access and accessibility and affordability. Perhaps, like some of you, I am, and certainly like many University of Oregon students, I'm a first-generation college graduate. My parents, although they didn't go to college, instilled in me the importance of getting a great education, but they couldn't afford to pay for that education themselves. I would not have been able to go to college were it not for generous scholarships. At the University of Oregon, Those scholarships are made possible through philanthropy, federal funding, and through state investments, your investments. College for me opened up vistas, introduced me to the world outside of Schenectady, New York, and prepared me for a career as a lawyer, a professor, a law dean, and now as a university president. That's why I'm passionate about public higher education and about the University of Oregon. It is through our great public universities that the vast majority of young people today, like I did 40 years ago, will get the will get the opportunity to be educated and transformed. The University of Oregon is poised to be able to expand our benefit and our service to students, our state, and our nation like never before. And this is an incredibly exciting moment at the University of Oregon. The legislature provided the state public universities with a new governance system, which is working extremely well and has given us the flexibility and the agility to advance our goals and our priorities. The governor has appointed an extraordinary board of dedicated alumni and professionals. Our faculty, alumni, administrators, students, and staff are hungry, palpably hungry to move forward. And the university has a committed leadership in place that is also ready to move forward. The University of Oregon cannot, must not, squander this moment. So we will move forward thoughtfully, carefully, to build our academic programs for the benefit of the state of Oregon. Priority one is to build our faculty and enhance our research. We will do that by hiring 80 to 100 tenure-related faculty members over the next 4 to 5 years. We want to attract world-class scholars to the university who will teach our students and create research that is central to our mission as a great public university. Priority two is to keep the university affordable to students so that they have the same opportunities that I had and that some of you may have enjoyed. That means not just looking to keep tuition increases as low as possible, but working to improve our retention and graduation rate. Because while a $300 tuition increase can be challenging for some faculty, it is minuscule compared to the cost of taking an additional term or a year or 2 years to graduate. A four-year graduation rate of 49% and a six-year graduation rate of 69% are unacceptable. They're the highest in the state, but they are unacceptable. We will increase our four-year graduation rate by offering more support and advising and ensuring that our classes are available to our students to get them on track, keep them on track. The state investment is vital for us to improve these rates. Our priority number three is to give all of our students a world-class education and make sure that they graduate and go on to great careers. This education means, in addition to what's going on in the classroom, great co-curricular activities and experiences, having them meet and get to know people from diverse backgrounds, people who don't look like them, haven't had their same types of lives, because that is where a great residential university excels, is having people meet people and get to know people who are from different backgrounds. I'd like to talk specifically about how these priorities benefit our state and why I hope you will join me in supporting what we are doing and helping us reach our objectives. Our success as a state is intrinsically tied to the success of our public universities. The University of Oregon creates a $2.3 billion economic footprint each year. That is money generating by, as all of our activities ripple out through jobs and business creation, through tourism, through construction, through grants and direct spending. But while that is important, that is really only part of the story. We know, and academic research tells us, that the greatest benefit from higher education is to create an educated workforce, a workforce that will encourage employment to locate in our state, employers to locate in our state. It is also a great university fosters discoveries and enhances prosperities. You've no doubt heard the facts before. College graduates will earn more than $1 million more in their lifetimes than students who do not attend college. And those earnings grow far more for people with master's and PhDs. College graduates also pay more in taxes, are more involved in their communities, are healthier and happier. I know that I'm preaching to the choir when I talk about the value of higher education, because I know, as members of the committee, you understand all of the societal benefits that accompany attaining a degree, and that you are focused on providing the path to prosperity for all Oregonians. And our state has set concrete goals to increase the percentage of Oregonians who graduate from college. But unfortunately, even with the recent increases of this year, Oregon's funding for higher education does not even come close to reflecting those values and aspirations. In the most recent comparison available, Oregon was 47 out of 50 states in state funding per student. 47 out of 50 states. Last weekend, Utah played the Ducks. I'm sure many of you may have watched that. I know I did, painfully. I had a chance to meet with a few of the students who came to the game. They have similar hopes and dreams as our Oregon students. And yet, those Utah students receive 4 times the level of support from their state as our students do. $2,000 per capita at University of Oregon, $8,800 per capita at the University of Utah. Investing in higher education is money well spent. As we've seen in other states, outstanding public universities work as a magnet. Top-ranked, nationally recognized universities work as a beacon for prosperity. They keep the state's best and brightest students. They attract the nation's top scholars, researchers, and professors. They bring in industry, create business opportunities, enhance arts and culture, solve problems, and prepare an enlightened, well-rounded citizenry that is at the center of any great, prospering state. Finally, before I close, I want to take a moment to give you an update on how the new structure for higher education in Oregon is working to benefit our students and the state. In 2013, you took a risk. You created boards of trustees for the University of Oregon, Portland State University, OSU, and the other universities. Many feared that this new structure would cause costs to increase and the interests of our universities to splinter. Nothing could be further from the truth. Instead, we have created an effective shared service enterprise that is customer-focused and managed collectively by the universities. I and the other university presidents, including the gentleman next to me, have worked together to successfully reach agreement on our first statewide university SEIU contract outside of the OUS system, and we did so in a way that avoided a strike authorization vote. And as you urged us to do, we have worked collectively for the future of our state, advocating together for significant reinvestment in higher education and for our students. At the University of Oregon, this governance change has had a tremendous impact on our students. Private philanthropic gifts are providing funding for scholarships so first-generation students like me can attend the UVO, and state support has allowed us to increase advising. And at this very moment on campus, Construction crews are renovating some of our largest learning spaces, financed through bonds that have been issued directly by the University of Oregon. One more example of how the shift in governance is benefiting our students and the state. We appreciate the authority you granted and the resulting flexibility to act in the interest of students, faculty, staff, and the community. We also recognize and accept the increased responsibility you and the citizens of Oregon expect and demand. I'm grateful for and respect your resolve to let the new structure work. I'm here in large part because of the challenge and opportunity to fashion a new way, a better way for the University of Oregon to achieve its potential using the tools provided by legislative action. And I look forward to a return visit so I can continue to keep you updated on our progress that we are making in Eugene. And so I again want to thank each and every one of you for all that you've done already to support these priorities, from giving us a governance structure to seek these priorities to providing the funding to seed many of these great initiatives. But we're not done, not by a long shot. Oregon still lags the country in funding for higher education, and the result has closed the door of opportunity for too many young people and weighed down our economic growth for too long. We must do better, and we will. And I look forward to working with you in February to build on our recent progress. Thank you.
Thank you, President Schill. I hope you can stick around for a minute. Maybe we could hear from President Insko and then have a broader discussion. President Insko, please.
All right. Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. I'll try to keep this relatively brief so we can get to questions. It's nice. President Schill and I just started on July 1, but already had a pretty good idea what the focus of his talk would be, so I think I'll give you a different perspective at EOU. But
Mr. President, I'm sorry to interrupt you. One of the strange formalities of our system, we need to have you identify yourself for our record, please.
Got you.
Thanks.
I'm Tom Insko, president of Eastern Oregon University.
Thanks.
I was honored to be appointed EOU's president on July 1st of this year and appreciate your invitation to speak here today.
Thanks.
Before I begin my comments, though, I do want to acknowledge those of you that recently came to Eastern Oregon to attend the Pendleton Roundup. Hopefully you fully recovered. It was good to see you. Rural communities of Oregon appreciate when you visit and embrace our traditions that make us unique. Hopefully you had a lot of fun, too. It was good to see you and the governor. Rural Eastern Oregon is special to me. And Eastern Oregon University has a special place in my heart. It is not because I'm president of this fine university. Rather, it is because in my attending EOU, I personally was provided a pathway to possibility that I never dreamed existed. I was born and raised on a family farm just 35 miles north of La Grande, where EOU is located. From the day I was born, I've known EOU. I crawled and then walked the grass of the football field as my father coached the Mountaineers. Later, when my father transitioned to be head coach of the men's basketball team, and while serving as their ball boy, I dreamed of playing college basketball. I experienced how big the world is when our family moved to Mon-Chuk, when administration of EOU's Micronesian teacher education program was the next position of choice for my father. With time, I became more conscious of the lives changed by EOU programs. As a professor of health education and while completing his career as dean of distance education, I experienced countless people raving about how my father, how EOU, cared about them and their success. My ties are deep with Eastern, obviously. In 1994, I graduated from EOU with a degree in mathematics and business economics. I also was able to fulfill my dream of playing college basketball. But more importantly, while at EOU, I blossomed into a confident leader prepared to excel in graduate school at the College of William & Mary, where I received my master's in business administration. I passed on job offers in the financial and technology sectors to pursue a career back in the Pacific Northwest for a manufacturing firm of wood products, a company called Boise Cascade. My recent move to be president at EOU ended a 20-year career with the company, where my final position was area manager for inland operations with approximately 1,200 employees. In this position, I was responsible for 9 manufacturing facilities that included 2 plywood plants, a stud mill, 4 lumber mills, a glue lam beam and decking manufacturing facility, and a particle board plant. I also managed state and federal forest policy activities for the company. While working in the wood products industry, I remained connected to EOU, the region, and the state. I served as a trustee and officer of the Eastern Oregon University Foundation and as president from 2012 to 2014. I currently serve on the Oregon Board of Forestry, and I'm a member of the Northeast Oregon Regional Solutions Committee. I also serve as a board member of the Western Resources Legal Center. Higher education in Oregon is in transition. I know you know this, but this is good. Funding models have changed to be more based upon outcomes, and governance structures have become more localized. I testified in support of these changes before I transitioned into higher education, and I support them today. Change was needed. Our challenge, however, will be to ensure we capture all the benefits of these structural changes while acknowledging where minor modifications are necessary to achieve desired outcomes. I'm excited to be leading through this historic transition. I chose to leave a successful career in the private sector to lead successful change at EOU. I observed during the last 10 years as EOU struggled with instability and seemingly perpetual shifts in focus. I did not decide to be a university president. I chose to be Eastern Oregon University's president. EOU is too important to the state, and especially the people of Eastern Oregon, to languish. I'm excited to be taking on the challenge of creating a successful future with the team at EOU and look forward to celebrating our achievements and transformation at our centennial in 2029. That's our planning horizon. EOU's financial stability will be built upon 4 pillars. 1, performance that is deserving of investment. 2, improved efficiencies and effectiveness in service delivery. 3, tuition and public investment. And 4, philanthropic support. All components of sustainability must work together for us to be successful. Higher education is critically important investment for the state of Oregon. However, we have an obligation to demonstrate meaningful performance improvement to justify our request for increased investment. At EOU, the high-level outcomes we will focus on are as follows. First, we must engage with our primary and secondary education partners, connecting with students early so we can provide them with visible pathways to college. We have taken a great step forward with the Eastern Promise. Second, we must implement a student success model that improves the likelihood that students will remain in school. EOU is focusing increased investment on student support services to dramatically increase retention rates. Third, we must improve graduation rates such that more students are receiving a degree and are prepared for a career or graduate school within 4 to 5 years. EOU's new Board of Trustees will play an integral role in our success as an institution. We have a passionate and participative board. Chaired by former State Senator David Nelson, our board is comprised of individuals from throughout Eastern Oregon who bring their expertise and passion for the region and higher education to the table. Leaders in their local communities, they are visible participants already in the university's advancement. Their significant and diverse professional experience coupled with their regional engagement allows for valuable guidance and input. Our new board is highly engaged and interactive with the campus community, already attending many functions. There is more accountability and informed decision support than could ever have been achieved under the former model due to the ability of EOU's local board to be engaged and personally vested in performance outcomes. Today is an exciting day at EOU. It's the first day of classes. Last week, we welcomed our freshmen and transfer students to campus, new freshmen. Our residence halls are at capacity. And there is an energy and sense of community on campus that, I am told, did not exist in past years. I joined our new students during a portion of their base camp, quote, base camp experience, where we transport them to large wooded camp areas and connect them with our beautiful natural environment while conducting team building sessions. At one point, the students were asked to raise their hands and walk across the circle if they were first-time, first-generation college students. I was unable to keep the tears from my eyes as I watched countless students cross that circle with hands raised. This is whom EOU serves. This is why I'm here, why we are here as an institution. Thank you for your time today and for listening to my testimony. I'm happy to take your questions.
Thank you. What a nice pairing you two represent. I appreciate it. Are there questions for for either of these presidents?
I have some.
Representative Wisdom, please.
Thank you. Thank you both. Welcome to your new jobs.
Thank you.
Coming to Oregon. This committee worked a lot last session on higher education, and affordability was one of our key objectives. I think the chair would agree and the committee would agree. And Mr. President, both Mr. President, I hope you'll keep affordability. And I think that both of you sort of indicated support of our new policy that HEC came up with. Not this committee, but I think the majority of this committee members support is our funding based upon graduation rates. I think that's a model that we're going to have to do. But welcome. We wish you all the luck. We dedicate our support to you. But I hope that affordability will maybe be the top priority, and that graduation rates we will see increase. Thank you very much for your presentations.
Representative Rudin.
Thank you both for being here. It's great to get to meet the new presidents. We had actually had, I'm glad you indicated your appreciation for the $7 billion that was came up with, but the ask early in the session was 7.55. If miracles happened and that additional 0.55 came forward, where would that first be spent?
So I can say for us, we're first. Thank you, Representative Reardon, Representative Reed. Where we would be allocating the money, if we were to get additional resources, would be first and foremost to get our students on track for graduation. As I said, this is one of my top priorities. It's an area where we lag our national peers, and so. What we would love to do is provide additional resources to Pathway Oregon, to other programs of advising our students. So that's number one. Number two is where the additional money would go into is faculty hiring. One of the things that has happened at the University of Oregon over time has been that our ratio of non-tenured faculty to tenured faculty has gotten off kilter. It's hurt our university. It's hurt our stature. It's hurt the students' education. It's diminished our research capability. All things that are important to the state of Oregon. So we would be utilizing the additional resources both to directly help our students and indirectly help our students with respect to building our faculty.
Thank you.
So a question I'd like to have both of your reactions to. You mentioned, President Schill, in your comments that the state's stated goals for higher education, 40-40-20, was involved in helping pass that. And I think the value is in the ability to evaluate individual proposals as to whether or not they move us toward that goal. But there's a significant flaw in that, too, in that it's a single measure, and different universities do different things, and there are lots of different measures of success. So I'd like to hear how you react, and President Isco, you made, I think I picked up some of what you were saying, some of the answer to this, but how do you construct for yourselves and your institution sort of your own balanced scorecard for your tenure?
I'll start off with that. We're in the process of developing that. You know, you you brought up the point, no one single measure is perfect, but you do have to measure outcomes. You have to manage towards those outcomes. So we're developing what I refer to as a dashboard of performance metrics that we utilize to inform how we're progressing towards the outcomes that we're after. So literally graduation rate, retention rates. But then as you think about running the institution, you refine those metrics in areas within your institution so that people deeper down in the organization can understand their connectivity to those final outcomes. And so it's a fairly, I'd say, somewhat complex set of metrics that are all connected to that overarching one of 40-40-20. In our case, graduation rates, retention rates, and pathways to higher education in the region of Eastern Oregon.
So like President Insko, we also have metrics. I have met with the board, and we've developed a set of goals for me, which are actually started this big, got a lot longer. Numbers are attached to almost every one of those. I'm a big believer in metrics. And then what I'm doing within the university is pushing down those metrics to the various offices, the various vice presidents who are working with them. But I have to say, our most important effort, the three goals that I gave to you: one, building our academic and research quality; two, sustaining affordability, as Representative Wisnant indicated; and three, providing for a great education and experience for our students. These are not sort of frills. This is what makes a great university. I view this as the three fundamentals. Every great university should do this. Oregon deserves a great university, and we are going to work on each one of them to make us as good as we possibly can. And where I will be able to judge my performance and the university's performance is seeing whether we achieve 80 to 100 great faculty members coming to the university, whether we can push up our graduation rate from 69% to closer to 80%, whether we can have our students go on to great jobs, all of those things we're going to be tracking. So we're going to be very intent on that. And if we are successful, in addition to all of those things, our university will increase in national stature. Every great dynamic economy in this country has a great university behind it. And we want to be that university. We want the state of Oregon to have a dynamic, excellent, and growing economy.
Thanks. Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair Reed. I want to thank you again for your presentation. I guess the thing I'd like to take away from this is when we think about affordability, as Representative Wisnant has pointed us to, I think we also have to appreciate the hydraulics of keeping all these things working together. It isn't just affordability. It's really the quality of student that comes out at the other end. And, you know, we talked about the guided pathways and how do we make sure that there's jobs, there's employability, and so on. So when we talk about faculty, I mean, how critical the faculty are to make sure that quality of education is there. And again, your discussion about, you know, your outcomes, I think the issue of teaching, service, and research. I mean, those three qualities have to be at our universities, and I appreciate the fact that you're both dedicated to that kind of outcome. So thank you again for your presentations.
One suggestion for your weekend entertainment is to watch the movie McFarlane USA. If you haven't seen the movie, I've used that in a couple of other committees about, I think it's a challenge for our education system, and I would challenge you new presidents, we've got to get the K-12 system better too, and anything you can do to help that. would be helpful. But this movie talks about the change in demographics, and we all know the demographics of the USA and Oregon are changing drastically. And the education, even in the higher education, should be focused on the student and that student's background, his ethics, as our population changes tremendously, demographics. So have enjoyed the movie. It's a good movie.
Thank you. He's mentioned it a few times. We know how much he likes it. It's good. So, President Shull, one of the things I shouldn't let you get away without, I made sure that the committee had seen the Chronicle of Higher Ed article. We had a brief moment to mention that in Pendleton, but I'd love to hear your reaction to that and how what you think of it. This is a piece, hopefully, that came on your email a couple of weeks ago, at least.
So I read the Chronicle. Obviously, he came in and he did interviews at the university. And I'd like to tell you all that everything in that article is untrue and that, our reputation is as strong as it ever was, that the education quality is as good as it ever was at the University of Oregon. But I can't tell you that. The article, factually, it's correct. And I think it provides a great marker for us. That is the baseline today. In a year from now, I plan on going to the Chronicle and show them all the things that we've done to improve things. And I want a rematch. And I want to be able to show them all of the improvements. And I want you to be my partners in that. Because our status as a university today, what the disinvestment that the university has experienced, that's what the article was about. What the article was about was it basically said the University of Oregon is a university that, because of state disinvestment, had to make choices. The choices that it made led to a decline in some quality. And if the university can achieve greater resources, either through state support, tuition support, and philanthropy, it can reverse that. And that was the message at the end of the article, as you know, is that looked at our plan, said, can we do it? And, it was a little too focused on me and too much about me as an individual, can I do it? It really, the issue is, can we do it? And by that I mean not just the folks down in Eugene, it's the folks in Salem. And so together, I want you to join me in a commitment, respectfully, in a commitment that we're going to look forward to our rematch at the Chronicle in a year from now.
Sounds like a good aspiration. I think everybody would agree with that. Representative Hoyle.
But first of all, I want to thank you both, for both being here and for caring so much. What comes through is that you really, really care about our kids that are going to school. And again, first-generation college student, it is so very, very important to me that we have the opportunities I had because of programs that kept kids in school that were unlikely to graduate from college. But I also, President Shull, I want to thank you for your honesty and for the forthright manner that you answered that question, and more importantly, for your commitment. I think you know that, in terms of the Lane delegation, we're there with you, but there's so many people from around the state that are there to work with you to help turn this around and make it happen. But I appreciate your direct manner you answered the question, and for both of you, for the hope that you've shown, that you've really expressed, and how much better things can be. And I recognize what our part is, and we'll certainly do our best to do our part, understanding there's a myriad of things we have to fund. But I just really, really appreciate both of you, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you can do.
Thank you.
Just looking up and down one last shot. Either you want to make any parting comments? I know you have busy schedules, and I expect we'll have lots more conversation, but I think you should, either or both of you should take the last word if you'd like it.
Just a couple of comments. There's affordability has been brought up a couple of times, and the way I look at affordability goes back to return on investment. And you can look at return on investment as a state. a student can look at return on investment. And so it's not so much about the actual tuition, but it's more about how we get to that endpoint, the career or going on to graduate school for a graduate out of EOU. And so that's why the investment in student services and all the way into the secondary ed level to provide that visibility is so critical for this state. But we're committed to demonstrating a very positive return on investment for this state. We've got opportunities to improve, but we're committed to that as an institution so that we can achieve that 40-40-20 goal, because it is a significant challenge for the state given what's in front of us. But we look forward to partnering with you, and we take that responsibility very seriously. Thank you.
And from Representative Reed, from the perspective from Eugene is, I think that when you come down and visit us, one of the things that I've been so impressed with and so excited, and I hope it percolates up here, because sometimes the press picks up stories that are not necessarily the most favorable or the most accurate I know you probably get that also, but the level of enthusiasm and the level of excitement and really the level of hope today in our universities, and I'll speak for the University of Oregon, is tremendous. And you all have made that happen. Your decision to move to independent boards and to more local control and flexibility has just, everybody is hopeful. And, you know, I can say from my university, which is a university that has really experienced its fair share, more than any university should have to, of leadership churn and sort of tumult. Our university, we are all unified now. We are ready to move forward. The alumni, the faculty, the students, everybody is really, really excited about what the future holds and how we can really tie back to both our legacy and our future as being an excellent, preeminent, nationally known, great research university. And the excitement is there. I invite you all to come down to Eugene, experience it, perhaps even come down on a weekend when we can give you some good news rather than last weekend. And it's really tremendous. So thank you all for your support, and I look forward to hosting you.
Thank you both for being here. Thanks for your comments and your dedication. We'll look forward to further conversation. Thanks a lot. And lest the committee think we've forgotten the other parts of our title, we're going to hear from Smart Cities Initiative that Innovate Oregon and the Technology Association are undertaking. We've got Skip Newberry and Thompson Morrison with us. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Reed and members of the committee, my name is Skip Newberry. I'm president of the Technology Association of Oregon. We're a tech trade association that represents about 350 companies, both very large and very small, throughout the state. And I'm very pleased to be able to take an opportunity to speak with you today and with Thompson Morrison, who's the executive director of our foundation, who you'll be hearing from as well, about a couple of projects we've worked on over the past year that are really thematically about, this focus on connection to a sense of place. And we heard from the university presidents, and I couldn't help but think a little bit about the ways in which the universities and the higher ed ecosystem are really very much focused on helping to build pipelines of talent from within the state and the communities in which they serve, connecting them to industry and to future careers. And a lot of what we're trying to do in the context of TAO and our foundation is to focus on the pipeline issues as it relates to talent, specifically for the technology industry. And that's broadly defined these days, where it includes a lot of other types of companies who are looking for people with skilled workforce and skill sets that can be applicable in the 21st century economy. And over the last year, we started to do some research where we looked at the tech industry here and its employee base and said, how important is this connection to a sense of place to you? And we were somewhat surprised by the sort of support we got, not only from the executives, but also the rank and file employees, saying that it's very important. In fact, it's a competitive advantage for the companies and for the region. A lot of the people who chose to live here, to build their careers here, who moved here, did so because they felt that the community itself, the infrastructure it had, the quality of life was fantastic. And they were also able to find great professional opportunities alongside that. And so if we're going to continue to be a talent hub, which is increasingly the big input to growth that's required to grow a vibrant tech community, we need to be thinking critically about what are some of the ways that we can solve some of the challenges that exist within our sense of place, you know, our cities, our communities. And so out of that, we ended up involved in a couple of different projects. One was in an urban setting in the city of Portland, and the another was in an agricultural region outside of Independence, Oregon. And I'll talk a little bit about how that came to be. We learned a lot during these projects we worked on over the last year, including how to potentially apply a new framework for economic development that could apply equally as well in an urban setting as well as a rural. We looked at different ways to leverage assets that exist already within a community. It could be farms in one case. It could be a particular you know, area of city blocks in another where there's infrastructure that could be available. And what we did is we said, okay, this is interesting to tech companies because they're oftentimes looking to prototype new technologies and to gain experience with new markets. And these markets, agriculture and urban environments, respectively, are representative themselves of multi-trillion dollar global markets. So if we can figure out ways to create living laboratories here on a smaller scale, and then perfect new technologies and develop relationships between companies, both large and small, there's a very interesting opportunity at looking at how that could become an economic development model where we're looking at increasing exports and the expertise that exists within those projects to a variety of other markets globally. They're all facing the same challenges. Now, the other interesting hook to this was that we also, in working with the foundation, figured out ways that we could incorporate applied learning opportunities where kids and students in higher ed and K through 12 get real world opportunities to learn and work alongside mentors from tech companies. And to take a step back and provide a little bit of context on sort of being better able to understand what we did with the projects, I think it's useful to first start by recognizing a few trends that are happening right now. So one is the price of technology is plummeting. So you have devices and computing power that is really inexpensive to deploy, and it's becoming increasingly ubiquitous. So you can create sensors and deploy them around a district, a several blocks within a neighborhood, and do so for, you know, $5,000-$10,000, whereas, you know, just 5-10 years ago, it might have been $5 million. So you're able to get insight by collecting a lot of data from these sensors. And cities are all over the world doing this in kind of new and interesting ways. And they're leveraging the emergence of this thing called the Internet of Things, which is the idea of you take a device or an object and you connect it to the Internet, and then it's thereby made smart or intelligent. You're able to learn about the data that's being collected from it, from the environment. And for consumers, what we're seeing is an increase in wearables and 3D printing and education and agriculture, the smart home. These are all areas or markets in which this technology is being applied. For businesses, it's in manufacturing, healthcare, and medical, and agriculture and food. And for cities, what's interesting is that we're seeing a lot of growth in the smart home right now, but it's going to quickly be eclipsed by urban infrastructure and infrastructure within communities in rural and urban areas combined. And Gartner estimates that there's 1.1 billion connected things used in smart cities today. And by 2020, it's going to be 10 billion. So it's increasing exponentially. The other interesting thing is that if you look at these types of investments, they're being used to create smart parking applications, more efficient lighting systems, looking at different ways that all of the problems that our mayors and communities, large and small, face can be addressed. It could be, you know, issues around CO2 emissions and climate change. It could be health and wellness and activity levels of residents. It could be congestion around transportation systems. And so in Portland, we decided we were going to do a project that was sponsored in part by the National Institute of Standards and Technology and the White House, which issued a challenge to a bunch of cities internationally this past year. It was called the Global Cities Team Challenge. And what the federal government recognized was that it's an opportunity to create common standards around these emerging technologies and apply them in ways that they could solve some of these global problems that exist, you know, related to resiliency, health and wellness, climate change. And so we decided we'd take two assets that exist along a couple of city blocks in Portland, essentially a transit corridor that had multiple modes of transportation, and then also look at air quality, so CO2 emissions. And we used sensor networks to look at data in both cases. We worked with TriMet and Portland State University and Intel, as well as a host of other smaller and medium-sized companies on data visualization applications and a bunch of other aspects to this. And what was interesting was over 9 months, we learned a lot about that particular corridor. And we then presented in Washington, D.C. in June, where this project was one of two in out of 70 internationally that were selected by the government of the Netherlands, the king and queen, in fact, for a partnership opportunity. The other was New York. So here was a case where a city from Oregon was punching way above its weight. And out of that, we've now since had opportunities to establish partnerships and relationships with other cities around the U.S. and internationally who are saying, we love the work that you're doing. We're doing something similar. Let's talk about what we're learning. And what this means for the tech industry locally is it represents a quickly growing market where they are now in at the ground floor because of this prototyping project they did here. And now as other cities start to adopt similar programs and initiatives, there's an opportunity for those tech companies to do the same work and replicate it in markets all over the world. Now, the interesting thing about this is that as we're looking at kind of where we go next, We're also talking with a variety of different mayors around the state about some of these applications, and many of them apply in very small communities just as well as very large. Last week, I was at a League of Oregon Cities conference over in Bend talking about a lot of this work, and not surprisingly, a lot of the mayors are looking at, okay, what role does fiber and infrastructure related to broadband and wireless play in allowing us to do some of these projects? We heard from an economic development director in Independence who's got everything from smart parking and metering and a bunch of other applications that they've developed and deployed in a town of 3,600 on top of a high-speed fiber network that they happen to have there. And so this is happening, and it's happening not just in major cities. The interesting thing about this, too, is that we look at kind of where we go next and what are the pieces of infrastructure we need to make this viable. Well, we need to have standardized data that different communities know what to do with and can access and then publish out both to academic partners, to private sector folks, to students who want to manipulate the data and create visualizations and apps that can then be used meaningfully to change behavior. And that's the holy grail here is how do you take interesting science experiments done in these small little sandboxes that are being created in communities and enable them to influence behavior in a widespread way. You think about it, this transit corridor we're working on in Portland, if you can provide people with the data they need to be able to travel through the corridor in such a way that they know what the impact is in terms of a mode of transit, in terms of CO2, they might say, okay, I'm going to go with the lesser impact today because I have some extra time to spare. And then in another day, they might say, okay, I've been told by my doctor I need some more exercise. So I'm actually going to look at the active forms of transit, and here it all is. So that's kind of where this is headed. We have a long way to go, but we're trying to position the region as an early adopter and an innovator in that space. The other thing that I'll mention in terms of where we go next in infrastructure, we've been looking at the fact that a couple weeks ago there was an announcement of hundreds of millions of dollars of federal funding across a number of agencies looking at different ways that smart infrastructure can be utilized to achieve policy goals, transportation, health and wellness, et cetera. And so we're working with our university partners. OSU has now been brought in as well. Where we're looking to position these projects for additional ongoing funding. I want to pause there because a lot of that context is, I think, necessary to understand sort of some of the work that the foundation is doing, and hear a little bit more from Thompson about how the talent development angle is being worked into this emerging economic development framework. Thompson?
Before you get started, let's just ask you if there are any questions from the committee, since you gave us a lot.
Sorry, that was a lot. No, it's good.
Yes. I have to compliment you. There's not very often that we hear that much content without a lot of slides, so that was a nice, nice contrast.
I think Redmond is participating in this.
It is. Yep.
Mayor.
Yep.
Representative Rudin.
I can't think of a really intelligent way to ask this. So you've kind of gone beyond laying that little rubber hose thing across the road.
or the clipboards,
Could you give us just a hint of how you collect all of this data? It just sounds like they're going to know everything about everything I do. And I'm not too sure I like that. But.
Right. So what was interesting was the transit corridor we looked at already has sensors deployed there. So TriMet has sensors on buses where they look at vehicle location and frequency data. There's information that we're sending as individuals with smartphones up into the ether on a regular basis, and it's being collected by a variety of people. I think the interesting thing here is, with all the data being thrown off, there's an opportunity for academic research. So Portland State University has one of five transportation centers that are designated federally. And they've been involved in creating a data hub that monitors a bunch of data from transportation systems throughout the region. And they were a key partner in this, where they were looking at insight that can then be used to inform policymakers at the city of Portland about, okay, what routes are people really taking across multiple modes of transit? What's the most efficient way to get there? Where are their safety concerns? Where are their congestion issues? And then what we did is we layered in a CO2 impact on top of that. So we're deploying sensors that measure air quality in the region. You can draw a correlation between the air quality and a different mode of transit or a congestion space. But your point about, you know, the privacy concerns, I mean, that's definitely something that is going to be a topic that's going to come up frequently throughout all these discussions, that insecurity. So I think that by trying to create smaller, manageable areas of study, where you have academic partners, experts from industry, the public sector involved in an open and transparent way, you're able to figure out, okay, what are some of the technological issues to get this stuff going? But then also, what are some of the concerns we might have from a policy standpoint? Like, for example, if you get a lot of data on CO2 impact and you find that it disproportionately impacts one particular neighborhood, if you made a decision as a public entity to release all that data without a lot of context, you could potentially impact home values dramatically overnight with the snap of the fingers. Mm-hmm. And that has real economic impact and consequences to a lot of people. So there's a number of issues around a lot of the data, which those are not new issues. Those have existed for a long time. So those are things we're going to have to think about as a society. Once we collect the data, what do we do with it? How is it released? What are the expectations around the data? And those are things that will be interesting to work on as we go.
Great. Thank you. That's very helpful.
Thanks for the pause, too.
Yep.
Mr. Morrison.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Committee. I am Thompson Morrison, the Executive Director of Innovate Oregon. To understand our story of Innovate Oregon, I must reel back about 5 years when we at the TAO began to re-envision who we were as an organization. Previous to that, we had operated as a traditional trade association. And at that point, we decided to define a much higher aspiration for ourselves and a much greater challenge. And that was a challenge to see ourselves as a catalyst for an economic renaissance and to be a part of creating an economic, a mecca of innovation here in Oregon. And so we as an industry recognized that in order to do that, we needed to think differently and we needed to engage the community in a different way. And we needed to begin to look at the assets we had around our community and align around a shared transformational vision. And as we did it, it began to work. And our industry quickly became one of the fastest growing industries in the entire country. And the impact went far beyond just the industry, and the entire state began to have an impact. 8 years ago, we were measured about 45th in the country in terms of entrepreneurship and innovation. We're currently fifth. The impact is significant. There was only one challenge, and this is a challenge that we began to face at the TAO, and that was the challenge of talent. We did not have the people that we needed to continue to grow. And so we began several different campaigns of how do we import people? How do we bring people into Oregon? in order for us to meet that short-term need. But we recognize that meeting that short-term need was unsustainable, certainly from an economic development standpoint, certainly for our future, and certainly for our kids, because we began to look at this and say, how are we preparing our kids for our jobs? Because as we began to go around the state, we began to realize and talk to different industries, and they said, we have the same problem. We don't have the talent. So the talent issue that we are facing is not to the single sector. It's across all industries and across all regions within this country, within the state. And the challenge is that we are not preparing the right kid, the right talent, because what the industry needs are creative problem solvers. And we've had a system in place for all that hasn't really fundamentally changed in over 100 years, that has not been creating and empowering the problem solvers with the skill sets that we need. So we as an industry began to realize that we not only had a crisis, the system had a crisis, and we began to look at this as, how do we participate in this? How do we become an agent of change, a transformation change, as a partner with our educators and as a partner with our entire community? And so we began working with different high schools. We went into Franklin High School up in Portland, and we began to ask the kids, what do you want to solve? What are the problems that you want to solve? Because we began to realize, as we began to talk to our kids, the leading reason that we were having such a low graduation rate was because of the crisis of relevancy. The students in our educational system were looking around, particularly when, by the time they hit their high school years, that critical point in terms of defining their career, they were looking around and going, why am I here? I'm just following a set of orders. I'm sitting here in a chair. I'm not making a difference, and I want to make a difference. And so we began to challenge them. We said, what do you want to transform? What do you want to solve? And we began as an industry to work with them, and we created something called an Innovation Academy, and we piloted it there, and we said, let's go partner with our industry, and let's go solve problems that you care about. And when we did that, there was a transformation in their passion for learning. We quickly began to see them not as compliant learners, but as inspired learners. And other people began to see that, and we began to share that with Madison High School. And then we were challenged. We said, okay, fine. Can you do this in a rural community? What about transforming in not just a school in a rural community, but an entire community? So we went down to Dayton, Oregon, a town of 2,500 folks. They have 2/3 of the community there living in poverty. Not a lot of opportunity. Lowest math scores in Yamhill County. And we said, what if we reimagined this entire community as a hub of innovation? And they said, let's do that. And I said, in order to do that, everybody has to be aligned. The mayor has to be aligned, the superintendent has to be aligned, the principal has to be aligned. And they said, we get it. We're here. That's the mayor, that's the superintendent, that's our business leaders, let's go. So we launched that about just over a year ago. And we said, we went to that community and said, who are we? What are our values? And what do we want to change? What do we want to transform? And we brought students together to work with the adults in the community, bringing our 21st century skill sets that we bring from our industry to help them solve problems. And they said, this is amazing. Can you bring this into our school and make this a requirement for every single student in our school? And we said, yes, we can do that. So we quickly spun that up. And then they began to look at that, and they saw what happened to the students when they not only were learning the skills. The students want to learn these skills. They want to learn about computational thinking. They want to learn about design thinking. They want to learn about engineering thinking. This is what they care about. They realize this is the future. And they began to see what was happening within that school, within that class that we came into, and they said, we've never seen students learning like this. And we said, we're just working with them like we do with a company. We call it agile. We're just going and very quickly solving problems together. We're building skill sets, and we're going to solve problems. And they said, could you do this in other subjects? We said, sure. It's just a process of listening to what's important to them, focusing on them on that, and let's work together in partnership to solve problems. And in that process, they will learn. And so they said, how about math? How about trig? I know nothing about trig at this point. But I said, sure, let's go try that. So we found some online resources through Khan Academy. We partnered with teachers there. And then we talked to our friends over at ODE and says, we always talk about contextualizing math. How do you contextualize trig? And I said, well, that's trusses. And I said, I didn't know what a truss was. And so I quickly explained a truss was. In fact, there was a truss manufacturer in Dayton. So we brought in that manufacturer, and they said, well, we haven't been in a school in 20 years. And I said, fine, let's go define a problem, and let's see what would happen to the students. And so while they were learning basic skill sets and with individualized learning, working as teams, they then had to solve a problem where they had a 1,000-square-foot building that they had to price out the roof on that. Well, in order to price out that roof, they needed to do a few things. They needed to understand what the cost of lumber was, what the foot of how lumber comes, but they also needed to know how to design a truss. And guess what? Truss requires trig. Over that three-week period, those teams worked, and they presented solutions that blew everybody in that building away. 3D modeling. No one taught them how to do 3D modeling of trusses of these buildings. But the students knew. They had been doing this on their own. And all of a sudden, the school began to look at that and say, we have been underestimating what our students are capable of. We need to reimagine this. And as we began to tell the story, we began to realize that this is not a single story to Dayton. This is a much larger story. And we began to tell the story of Innovate Oregon, where we need to build an inclusive innovation-based economy that empowers everybody in our economy to be an active participant in the creating the possible, making creating. And so we began working with Independence. We began working with Umatilla. We began working with Yamhill Carlton. And in fact, Independence, because of the foresight they had to put fiber in the ground 10 years ago, said, well, let's move fast. Let's start putting projects in here. Let's bring smart cities in here. Let's start creating AgTech project and working with the students. And we said, what if we claimed the entire city here as an innovation city? So they became Oregon's first Innovate Oregon City. They've declared it, and the banners are now hanging in Independence. Dayton said, well, wait a minute. What about us? We want to be an Innovate Oregon City. And we said, you got it. Make the proclamation. They put the proclamation in place, and they said, you know what? We not only want to do that, but we want to build an I-3 center. And I said, what's an I-3 center? An I-3 center stands for Inspiration, Innovation, and Invention. We want to build, in our Building 60 that stands behind our school, a new place, a place where you have not only our world-class ag program and our machine shop and our art studio, but we also have a digital makerspace and a digital lab for kids, students, where we as a community come together to create new possibilities. And we want to create a statewide model. So they are building the state's first I-3 center. Yamhill Carlton, the same day they heard that, they said, we want to build one too. What's happening here is that the communities around our state want to be a part of this story. They realize that the future lies in the new possibility that are opening up as technology is completely remaking our entire industry, every single industry in our state. And the students want this, and the teachers want this. And if we begin to tell that great aspirational story and begin to live that aspirational story, we have an opportunity here in Oregon to create a national model. Because as you well know, we have one of the lowest graduation rates in the country, second lowest. When you are in the tech game, when you're in the innovation game, you can never play catch up. You will always lose. That's the nature of the world that we live in. Because competitive advantage is based on rate of innovation. And if you try to play catch-up, if we just try to catch up with other states, we will lose. We need, the only way to succeed is that you go and you leapfrog. And that's what we're doing here in Oregon, is that we're saying, let's reimagine this, and let's create a national model, and let's do that fast. And that's what we are doing together with all of our partners within Oregon. Thank you.
Everybody's going to have questions, yeah. I suspect. Representative Wisdom, go ahead.
Has anyone been to OMSI lately? My 10-year-old grandson in August was at OMSI, and he built the bridge that could handle a bus first and then a train, choosing the right trestles to get across it. They have so much stuff there. How do you get around OEA? How do you get around doing all this stuff? How is it connected to the school system? Is it after school? Is it weekends?
It's everything. So essentially what you have to do is you have to begin to blur the boundary between what happens after school and what happens during the school.
So it's after school.
And so after school is a very critical component because that is when students have the opportunity to have the time to actually work and go deep into complex problems. And OMSI is one of our partners. And OMSI, as you know, is very dedicated to a statewide initiative. And so we're working very closely with them to say, how do we leverage the sources of OMSI as part of this story? But what happens is that, I'll give you an example of this. Out in Umatilla, I'm sure many of you have been to Umatilla. There's not a lot in Umatilla. Except I walked into a seventh grade class in Umatilla. And a girl walked up to me and said, hello, Mr. Morrison. How are you? May I give you my card? Hmm. And I said, thank you. What's this for? Oh, it's for our drone team. Oh, your drone team? Really? She said, would you like to meet my other teammates? I said, I'd love to meet your other teammates. So she took me over to a class. It was completely unannounced. And I walked in, and she introduced me to other teammates. And then she said, oh, and over here, that it's going to be a little bit like Jack's drone over there. Would you like Jack to explain his drone? And I said, sure, I'd love to. And so Jack walks over, looks me in the eye, shakes my hand, and said, yes, that was my first version. I'm currently redesigning it. It's on the 3D printer right over there. And I said, really? Why did you redesign your drone? And he said, well, and he went through an intricate explanation of all the design changes. And I went, why is it that if we can do this in Umatilla, we can't do this everywhere? Now, that started as an after-school program. But what quickly happened is that they began to realize in order to build the base skill sets, they had to do the 21st century skill set building during the day. And so we see where our children are walking down through their towns, seeing Innovate Oregon banners so that they realize they're part of innovation culture, are building 21st century skills within the school day, and then actually using that to create and make new things in the after-school environment.
So I think I may just be restating Representative Wisdom's question, but what are the barriers that you're encountering as you try to grow and scale this approach?
So the barriers are that we are learning as we go, that we are rapidly, so that we're working very quickly. We use what's called an agile process where we work everything within, in our case, we work on 6-week sprints. The barriers we have is actually getting the funding cycles in place from the foundations and other institutions that's in alignment with the rate that we are moving. Because the normal funding cycles tend to look in a year-long process. If you could imagine where we're here today a year from where we went, I mean, Representative Reardon sat down with me one day for a cup of coffee. And he said, what about David Douglas? And we said, what about David Douglas? I used to teach there. We need to do something at David Douglas. Over the summer, we spun up an innovation academy at David Douglas, where we brought in the best shoe designer in the world to teach rising ninth graders who had been identified at risk, working and also lead another team working on robotics, another team working on coding, computational thinking. What happens is that all of a sudden, you have to learn and pivot fast. So the greatest challenge we face is that we're moving faster than the institutions that are around us.
That's not surprising.
This is the nature of the tension that we walk into, which is actually a very positive tension. We refer to this as the ecotone. So ecotone is an ecological term, it's a term in biology, where one ecological system overlaps with another ecological system. They are very different. It's like when the fresh water goes into the ocean. There is a tension that happens in there. We're in the middle of that. So that's really the great challenge that we have.
So where do you see that tension going? What's the best thing that we should be keeping in mind as policymakers and what actions we might be taking to help with those barriers?
So we work closely, for instance, with ODE around the STEM funding and the CT funding that's coming in. And I actually sit on the STEM Investment Council. And so we're having very valuable discussions and very frank conversations around this in a very positive light. How do we begin to implement where we can allow ourselves to pivot and modify as we go? So the question is, how can we begin to create a reserve of funding that allows us to make strategic investments that allow us to be able to quickly learn and to modify to learn fast? And so the challenge is to figure out, is to understand how do we begin to use those resources to allow us to spin up, essentially, new pilots quickly, learn from them. And so there, you know, you are working within a system that is designed for controls because you have a very important fiduciary responsibility. How we navigate that is something that we really need to explore so that not only do we maintain the infrastructure that you're working in, but that also it reflects the fact that we are working also as an industry in partnership with you in a way that requires perhaps a little bit more agility than is normally there.
Very diplomatic. So at the risk of oversimplifying it, is it the case that the legislature and the department could say, here's an X dollar fund inside which exists much more flexibility and adaptability?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, but Representative Gallegos and I, we've been working on the ELL program for year and a half, 2 years for my case. But the problem is education. I went to this NCSL. I'm on the education of NCSL.
Education Commission.
Not the commission. It's the committee, education subcommittee. And there's a school district in Colorado Springs that is all proficiency. And because the problem is people learn at different times. And our school system is set up that this curriculum, the student has to sit in the desk and for a certain number of times to learn this curriculum, okay? But if that person takes twice as long, they might be just as smart, but they do it at their own pace. And if one takes it in half the time, they can do it in half the time and move on to something else or go into innovation or have this stuff. But we go in the classroom and all 30 kids or 25 kids sit there and they have this block of education they have to learn within that certain time. We're individuals. And every one of those students are smart as all get out. The time limit and how we're structured, it should be more individualized and focused on the student and not set time limit to learn this stuff, and then we got to move on to something. If you lost it, you're lost it. You're never going to catch up. And if you learn it in half the time, you're bored and you're going to get in trouble like my grandson does for, behavior because he's bored.
Right.
So and we this really need to change the whole education system to be individualized and use technology that these 10-year-olds and 8-year-olds can outdo me on video games and all that stuff.
And indeed, this is our greatest challenge. It is that cultural challenge. And so what we've done is this. When I asked Heidi Seip, who's the superintendent in Umatilla, I said, Heidi, how did you do this? How did you actually reimagine your entire school system here? She said, Thompson, in Oregon, we're local controlled. That means that I answer to the school board. Now, I have to follow the guidelines by IOD, but I really answer to my school board. And so long as my school board supports me and I can work within the guidelines, I have a lot of liberty. So what we did is I said, so Heidi, how many other superintendents think like you? She said, well, there are about 20 of us. I said, really? Because she's a member of, she knows all the members in COSA and all of us. I said, really? And they normally find their little corner and they chat together. And I said, have you ever heard of Rensselaer's study on tipping points? And she said, no. Well, Rensselaer Polytech did a study on tipping points. And they said, at what point will a new paradigm, a new model, quickly diffuse and become the new dominant paradigm. And it happens at 10%. Do the math. There are 197 districts. 90% of them are rural. 20 superintendents are already wanting exactly what you're saying. We have to reimagine this. Go. So last August, we had an innovation summit in the middle of a vineyard. We brought together those superintendents. We brought together our industry. And we said, what if we reimagined how we empower our students? Those are the superintendents that we're working with. So what you do is that we start and you create what's called, you create new models. So in Dayton has completely, in 1 year, they're completely re-envisioning how they're educating their children. They become a model for Yamhill. They become a model for others. We begin to learn from each other. So part of what we can do, because we're the outsiders in a sense, we're just trying to be good guys, right? But these are our children. This is our talent. This is our economic success. And we realize that this is not only a talent development issue, it's a community development issue, and it's an economic development issue in order for us to recreate that map so that a child who grows up in Oak Ridge, a child who grows up in Sweet Home, has the same advantages as a child who grows up in Beaverton or Hillsboro?
Go ahead, Ripson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the Khan Academy. That's the opportunity there is unlimited as far as courses that teachers and students can do. It's probably not being knowledgeable. The parents don't know about it, but it's there. It's free.
And what happens is that when you go into a classroom and you say, look, our responsibility as a team, as a classroom team, is to do this knowledge, is to actually, and everybody's going to go at their own speed. Well, what happens is that you're going to have some students who are going to go faster than others. And what we do is we've actually posted where everybody is, so everybody knows where they are. Why? Not because it's a competition, but because you identify your assets. Now when someone has a problem, you say, oh, Jack, why don't you go help Meg? Karen, you help Frank. And what happens is this dynamic of learning that changes the role of the teacher. It's no longer the sage on the stage model. It is the teacher facilitating the community learning. And when that happens, it is transformational.
Amen.
The 20 superintendents you mentioned, are they more of them rural than urban, or is it a mix, or how would you characterize them?
You know, it's funny. We started in Portland Public Schools, and nothing can be more challenging within a complex bureaucratic environment than PPS. And one of the things that astonished me was how fast you could move in a rural community.
Yeah.
Everybody knows everybody else. So the level of trust, relational trust, is there, and you can move fast. And so in our game, it's about your speed. What we began to realize is you can move fast. We actually thought, quite honestly, because I'm from Portland, so I'm very committed to Portland Public Schools. Both my kids went through it. We thought it would take 2 to 3 years for them to begin to kind of wake up and say, well, what's happening around us? How can we be a part of it? It happened just in a matter of weeks, because they began to hear, and the individual principals began to contact me and say, well, wait a minute. What are you doing down in Dayton and in Independence, and can we be a part of that? I said, you know, you're part of Portland Public Schools. You guys don't move very fast. Well, wait a minute. I think we can. So what happens is that the principals, that there is a desire within the system for change that is really quite powerful if we begin to allow it to happen and begin to guide this with a new model of learning together that will allow us to actually have an impact. So, for instance, Tualatin said, hey, can we be a part of this storyline? Sure. Who does not want their child to be part of an innovation economy? Which company does not want creative problem solvers? We all want this. The problem is we don't know how to do it. The process is that we're going to learn together, and we're going to learn fast. So that is why it actually is a process of real cultural transformation, but it's a cultural transformation that we all want and we know that we need.
We need, Mr. Chair, we need the education committee to hear this.
Yeah, so Representative Reardon is our liaison to the education committee. You may be inviting yourself back with your presentation today. What do you think, Representative Reardon?
Happen.
He'll look into it, I think. That's good.
Look, we'll see what we can arrange.
Perfect. Good.
I'm not in charge of that committee, but I'd see what I can do.
That's great. Representative McEwen.
And Mr. Chair, I have a sneaking suspicion that an email may be going out to some of our school districts with a link to this committee meeting.
That would be great.
Help enlighten some folks as well.
I'm sure Victoria can help us distribute the right links to your materials as well. That would be great. Any sort of, I don't want to cut the discussion off, but just making sure that everybody has a chance to say something. Representative Reardon.
One quick question. Do you work with the career technical student organizations at all in a partnership? Because they are kind of a combination of in-class and after-school activities. They emphasize leadership, technical skills. I'm just thinking as a teacher that might be receptive to your message.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's a reason that you never heard the term STEM once in my presentation, nor did you hear the term CTE. And it's because those are boxes that we have traditionally had to think about how to solve the problem. It is a larger issue that involves all of the CTE skills and all the STEM skills and all the language arts skills, and it's about creating the power of empowering the next generation of innovators. But the CTE, we have tremendous knowledge here. So I work very closely with folks with the Lemelson Foundation. I work very closely with Don Domes and others with on the CTE side, and with ODE, with Tom Thompson.
Good.
So we are very integrated because the I3 Center, inspiration, Representative Reardon, that's around tech, that's around CTE. That is the machine shop. That is about the, that's about all areas of inspiration. It's not that we are defining a pathway, but you should see the gate that the shop did down at Dayton, Oregon, which is the most beautiful farm gate I've ever seen in my life. Now, that was out of their CTE program, but it involved every... So you know what we're doing with that one? We are pairing them up with students who are struggling with math, and we're pairing them up with people from Portland Business School, from PSCU's Business School, to create a case study around building a business around building around those gates. So now the students who are struggling with math, not knowing why it's relevant, are actually going to be building a business plan. So now they know why they're doing the math to help the students who are in the CT program to sell their gates. This is the type of cross-disciplinary thinking that we need to empower students, because the creative genius within our students, as you know as a teacher, is immense. If we begin to empower them and challenge them for excellence, they step up.
Yeah. Representative McKeown.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like you have, 15 or so community partners. What is your bandwidth? What's your capacity for growth? And I'm assuming you have a connection with COSA. It sounds like you've had an opportunity to meet with some superintendents. Have you had an opportunity to present at the OSBA conference in November? This might be something that board members and board chairs might be very interested in.
I would welcome that opportunity. Thank you.
Second weekend in November every year.
There you go.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I want to thank you for your presentation. I'm coming at this from as a social scientist and a professor for many years. Okay. I always enjoy talking with or hearing from geeky people who sort of, can enlighten me with regard to a lot of things.
Right?
Yeah, definitely a compliment. Like I said, I love being enlightened in these areas that I'm not used to. But what you remind me of is one thing I've been talking to students about for a couple of decades now, that a couple of things. One, the solutions always sort of unfold from the definition of the problem. In other words, however you structure that problem, then, I don't know, it's magic. It just sort of unfolds from that. So your comments about different ways of imagining and sort of the innovation of really looking at the issues we're facing from a different lens, I think that's so critical for our young people. I mean, I'm very much aware that our old problem-solving models do not fit the kinds of world we live in right now. And so I'm very excited to hear your work. And I'm trying to think, how do we take that, and look at the tipping points with regard to our social world as well as our technical world. So, thank you.
What last thought do you think we should keep in mind as we head towards the February session? What do you want to leave us with? We've sort of covered so many different things. I'm finding myself, and maybe not everybody is in this situation, we're sort of, it's all inspiration, innovation, and invention is all in my mind. But where do we go with this?
I think the opportunity here is for us to co-imagine what the solution might look like. You all bring a tremendous amount of expertise and a tremendous amount of experience. We're bringing in a tremendous amount of expertise and experience. This is a problem that involves all of us and an opportunity for all of us. And so I think that we recognize that it boils down to that moment when a child all of a sudden sees their potential. And it happens, we call it the hello world moment. We recognize that at the most human level, that's what we're trying to do. But we are the elders here. This is our time of creating a legacy. How is it that we are creating a legacy that for our children? And so I think, Representative Gallegos, that is the key, is that we have to recognize that we have certain mindsets, certain frameworks that we're coming in because of the world that we've been living in. But we sit down and we talk and we listen to our students. Oh, by the way, I didn't tell you. Guess who's designing the I3 Center? It's not us. It's the students. They have an Innovation 101 class, and the job of that class now is there's six sessions of that class. Over a quarter of their students at Dayton are currently involved with. They're the ones telling us, what does this look like? We have an opportunity here to listen to our students in new ways. So I think that as we go into the February session, is to begin to find opportunities for us to go and begin to explore how do we begin to have the tool sets that allow us to be able to explore the funding opportunities to be able to take some risks to quite very quickly spin up new solutions here and to be able to become more agile ourselves. And that's how I would challenge pose as the greatest challenge. How do we all become more adaptive and more agile as we seek to solve this? Because our rate of change, the way that we currently are solving problems, is quite frankly too slow. Because every day we're losing another child.
Yeah, just one other thing to add. I mean, agility around the funding is key, and then also with regard to infrastructure that enables some of these projects. I mean, you look at the opportunity with the high-speed fiber network connecting all the research universities in the state. That's a tremendous opportunity where industry is really excited about investing in that. And I think upgrading that to the point where we're able to tackle some of these data-related issues that come out of all these projects that are going on around the state. In the higher ed context would be an interesting asset that would help enable some of the economic development outcomes, the talent development outcomes. It gives an opportunity for the student teams and others who are working on these projects to have an asset they can rely on to do a lot of the analysis that they're doing on the data. So anyway, that's one thing that could be an interesting thing to look at as well, just in the higher ed context itself.
Good reminder. Thank you.
The STEM, the funding, the additional funding for STEM, why couldn't some of that, even though Thompson doesn't want to mention it, and I think that's a good idea, but that this is related to STEM, and that some of that funding could be designated to help. I'm not sure exactly what funding. I'd want to know what you're asking for or you know, what it's going to be used for the I3Cs. But is anyone here on the STEM? Are you working on
well,
that?
Well, when we pass the funding package during the session, part of that I think would be helpful, and well, it would in that it would support CTE and STEM career-related classes. So the operation of those classes. So yeah, if you have those, but nothing
preparing people to get to that stage or whatever. I think it could be related. I don't know.
It does seem like that kind of question is the sort of thing to ask in preparation for the February session, and Ways and Means members can look into that as well.
Do you have a financial request or proposal that you could have for us?
That certainly can be prepared. But what we're doing right now is we're utilizing. So what
right
we're
answer.
Doing
right.
here's but we are very. What happened in the last session was very important for us, both in the CTE funding and the STEM funding. That was. So on the there was a total of about almost $40 million that was set aside. About 30 of that was designated towards CTE related, and about 10 or so to on the STEM side. About 6 of that million is for the STEM to support STEM hubs. We have about 4.7 million that we call the STEM investment grants. That's being allocated in three buckets. One bucket is for math related work, STEM. Contextualizing STEM, then there's about approximately going to be somewhere between around $2 million that's going to be allowed for STEM investment grants. Those STEM investment grants are going to be one that will be well positioned for supporting this type of work. So we already have money in place that we're already working with ODE to actually put that in place. So that's a piece that's important. The other piece, though, is to understand that we need to begin to. While we not necessarily want to immediately blur the boundary between CTE and STEM, because they are assets to leverage, so that a lot of CTE is around technology training as well. That's one component of that. So what we're trying to do is encourage the commingling of those solutions, because we don't see them as being different. We see them as empowering the next generation. So what we're trying to do is encourage fundings from the existing money that's been allocated and to actually leverage that to demonstrate how we can actually have a very clear ROI and really move the needle on that. That's a very core piece. What's also needed is capacity building. And so if we were to say we need project-based funding, we need capacity building for organizations like ourselves who are working to bring all these conversations together, we also need, as Skip was pointing out, infrastructure investment. I was in Sweet Home on Thursday. Sweet Home's, I was in the center of Sweet Home's Digital Learning Center, which is their library. Their up and down speed was 1 megabit per second. That's Sweet Home. They are not going to be participating. Independence up and down is 100 megabits per second. They could have a data center in Independence. They can't. We're unless we begin to think about that also as well, the infrastructure piece of it. So there, we're encouraging a very coherent strategy that looks at the infrastructure piece, the capacity building piece, and then the sustainable funding for these programs that inspire our students. So that would be the three-legged stool, that if we could find a way to have that conversation in unison, we would be able to leverage all of our assets and our potential, I think, much more significantly.
That's a good thing to keep in mind as we finish up. That's excellent. Thank you very much for a really inspiring discussion today. We'll have lots more, I hope.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And as we wrap up, having completed our agenda, I want to remind all of the committee members who are here, our next meeting is in November. We don't yet have our agenda completed for that. So as you see things you'd like to talk about or have before us, updates, I think we'll probably want to have an update on the Open Education Resources Bill. But beyond that, I think we're quite open. So please let me know. And in that, also in that spirit, remember that the February session includes three committee bills. I don't know yet which those will be, so if you have preferences or ideas for that, please let us know as well. Representative Wizard.
How about what in the heck?
The heck? They left already, didn't they?
Yeah, but weren't they going to come up with a plan for this funding based on graduation? Is that being...
We could have an update on that. They did present their... Make sure I use the right language, sort of their status while we were in session. That I think sort of the initial rollout of the model, looking at Victoria, if I'm remembering that right.
Yeah.
It was sort of in the process. They had developed it.
They told me I couldn't use that.
Performance based funding. We could ask for an update on that, on progress on that. That's a good suggestion. Anything else?
Thank you.
You're very quiet today, honorable colleague.
That's true. We're adjourned. Thank you.
I thought this would turn you on.
Yeah.